Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 12th, 2003. Today's session is entitled, Blaming the Germans. Not so fast, pal, they had lots of help. Session 5 of Afro-Asiatic Roots of the Old Testament, presented by Peter Nash, number NAP2003-05. Let's listen in.
My name is Peter Nash, and this is the fifth of five sessions, actually the four sessions within kind of a rest yesterday, about the Afro-Asiatic roots of the Old Testament. The title is Blame It on the Germans, Not So Fast, They Had Lots of Help. It was something like that, but the point today is that kind of moving back to the theoretical side of this to talk about in the late 20th, early 21st century, we like to blame the Germans for everything about racism because they're the most striking example, most shocking example of the 20th century, where 11 million people were killed for racial / religious motives. 6 million of them being Jewish, and that being their only crime. The rest being intellectuals, homosexuals, disabled people, and other intellectuals, other undesirables, as they describe us. But they're not, you know, they didn't do this all by themselves. We talked some on Tuesday, in the first session, about how, in my research, I can confirm that in the late Enlightenment in the second half of the 18th century, a coincidence of the development of physical anthropology as a science and social anthropology as an emergent science, also as an emergent science being applied to for the first time, being applied to the Old Testament, the study of the Old Testament. In the School of Medicine with Johannes Blumenbach, and in the School of Theology and Near Eastern Studies by Johann Michaelis, led to an unhappy combination, an unhappy trajectory for Hebrew Bible or Old Testament studies. In 2001, in May or April, Harvard University, the Department of Germanic Studies, and the Afro-American Studies, it's not a department, it's a committee, I think, at Harvard, jointly sponsored a symposium called the German Invention of Race. So it's convenient to blame it on the Germans, but they didn't do it all by themselves. It didn't start. Someone who was sitting over there, I think she's already left, challenged me when I put it in the 18th century. Said, "Oh, well, look at the 16th century already in the United States and South America. The slave trade is already booming," and she was absolutely right. I'm going to talk a little bit about that from the Spanish perspective, and the order today is sort of funny. This is a youngish, she finished her dissertation at the University of Chicago in 2000, and is teaching out in California somewhere, Maria Elena Martinez. I believe she's a Chicano American. I mentioned that every year Harvard has another symposium, not the one on race, but has a symposium on the Atlantic world, the history of the Atlantic world. And in 2002, she presented a paper on this topic, that religion, purity, and race, the Spanish concept of limpieza de sangre, the clean cleansing of the blood, or pure blood, in 17th century Mexico, or New Spain, and the broader Atlantic world. I'm going to talk after that, or kind of mixing together, about Catherine Turner, whom I don't remember so well, but she's a little bit older. She's an associate professor at the University of Chicago, and she's written several books already. And one of them is Theories of Culture, A New Agenda for Theology. One of the problems that we have in theological studies is, most of the human sciences, is we tend to think, we have tended to think
that what gets done in Europe, what gets done at Harvard, what gets done at Chicago, at Hopkins, at the big universities, is somehow pristine and without context, and therefore universal. We're looking for a little piece of the truth that we can then apply to everyone. And then if you don't quite fit that piece of truth, then there's something wrong with you. Or when we began to become liberal in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we began to talk about contextual theology. So that what was going on in Latin America with liberation theology was contextual theology. It fit for that context, but it couldn't be something for everybody. What was happening in Africa was contextual theology. What was happening with women in women's liberation theology, Rosemary Ruther, Elizabeth Schuster Fiorenza, that was contextual theology in the woman's context. What was happening with Jim Cone, Gay Rod Wilmore, in black theology was contextual theology, theology out of the black, or African-American sociological experience. And then later in the 80s, we got to gay theology and lesbian theology. We got to womanist theology. Black women were not satisfied with black male-oriented theology, which they thought was sexist. They were not satisfied with feminist theology, which they thought was still racist. So they developed womanist theology, and that was even more contextual. Yeah. So Tanner takes up the idea, well, culture seems to be pretty important in how we do theology. My complaint, and I don't know if I'll get back to it, so I'll say it now, is that it strikes me as very odd that, you know, white guys, they have no context. They're not doing contextual theology, so they must not have any context. And that's the universalization of traditional theology going way back into the early church has somehow been thought of as universal without context. But what's the first thing you do when you go to seminary or just take a simple basic course at college, one of the Lutheran or Methodist or Presbyterian colleges? You first have to study the context of Moses, of Jesus, of David, in order to understand what's going on. So they had context. Explain to me why Kant and Barth and Tillich don't have context, why they are not contextual theologians. And that's actually a big part of why I'm kind of mixed up in this stuff right now, instead of just reading and parsing verbs, which I was trained to do. So we start with a young Latina, we move on to a fairly young white girl, then we get to an older, near retirement, Martin Bernal, who is in and of himself an interesting story. An Englishman, these last two are Englishmen, so we've not only gone from female to male, but we've crossed the ocean, the font of all truth. But Bernal has spent all of his academic career most of it at Cornell University up in Ithaca, New York. This might be boring to you, but I always, because I'm so convinced that someone's context makes a difference in what they say and how they say it, I always tell my students, you know, read behind your sources. Find out who is writing, what their background is, because I think that's half of the battle, is to know where the person is coming from, sometimes even how much money they make, and how comfortable they are to say things in their situation. Bernal is started off as a sinologist, studying China back in the 50s and 60s. And then, unfortunately for him, being a socialist, he ran into the... everybody knew about the end of socialism as a world economic force long before we admitted that it had happened in the United States. We didn't start talking about it until 1988, 89. But all the people who were studying China and studying Russia knew that, the Soviet Union, I should say, knew that that system had long since collapsed in on itself. And most would say not because of the socialism itself, which few of those in power will admit to in the United States, but because of the corruption that was in the system. And oddly enough, the same thing seems to be happening with some of the democratic systems, that are capitalist systems. I promise myself I'd never make that mistake again, but some of the capitalist systems
as Enron and WorldCom have illustrated for us in the last few years. I was exceedingly angry when I realized that AES, which is the chief electricity provider in Brazil, once the Brazilian government denationalized the furnishing of electricity to the company, they sold what was left of this shell there to AES, which was in collusion with Enron. And so my electric bills in Brazil for the last couple years shot up dramatically because of what some people were robbing here in the United States. So if you lost employment, stock, money, your bills went up because of Enron, don't feel like you're alone. It was a multinational problem. So Bernal, that's a long parenthesis, wasn't it? Bernal, when he saw that there was not much interest in to study in that part of China, that aspect of China that he had specialized in for 20, 30 years, in the mid-70s, early 80s, switched over to the ancient Near East. He was a tenured professor at a great university. He could do whatever he wanted. That's why tenures are scary sometimes. And he became interested in first the Cadmean letters. There are a couple of inscriptions from Crete, or Cyprus, I always get this confused, that one set they can read, I can't. And the other set is still up for grabs as to what it means. And he started messing with the one, of course, that nobody could read, and as a consequence, he spread his interest out. He began reading a lot of stuff in ancient Near Eastern studies and classical Western, because this text are thought maybe to be the bridge between the Semitic world, the Afro-Asiatic world, and the beginning, the emergence of the classical world. So that burgeoned out until 1987 and 1992 or 91, I can't remember which. The first two volumes of Black Athena, Afro-Asiatic Roots of Classical Civilization, was published in 1987, and the second in 1992, I think. It was supposed to be four volumes. It got so interesting. There is a just in publications of Bernal and his critics is a library this thick now. The two of the four projected volumes, two volumes plus another book criticizing Bernal, and one book returning Black Athena Writes Back, where Bernal responds directly to the criticisms of Black Athena Revisited, which is a collection of classes, principally classicists, criticizing Bernal's methodology, correcting some of his mistakes. And that, actually, I've done a whole lecture at a museum in Brazil about the whole controversy, and maybe we can talk about that over coffee. But there's some pieces here of Bernal's work that I want to touch on today. And then finally, to complete the cycle, this is a dead white guy, which we all complain about, but some of them are pretty cool to read. Ivan Hannaford wrote a book and published a book in 1987. I think he published posthumously, Race, the History of an Idea in the West. Where I talk about racism or racialization in the study of the Hebrew Bible starting in the 1700s, 18th century, he pushes it back into the 13th century. And that sort of ties in with what Martinez does. So, sort of a picture of the people who are going to help me confuse you even more today about where some of our key ideas about race come from in the modern West. I just got to get this pot shot in because I don't know if I'll get to it in my notes today. Who's the great Western philosopher, modern Western philosopher? Somebody says you really got to read this guy. Who do y'all think of? No, I mean in the last two or three centuries. Descartes.
I was thinking of Nietzsche.
Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Tocqueville.
No, Whitehead is one of the states.
Pardon?
Whitehead.
Whitehead.
Kierkegaard.
Kierkegaard. That's some Danes here, I see. Well, that's a relief for me because I keep hearing that it's Immanuel Kant. And the thing that troubles me about Immanuel Kant is that, first of all, he's a physicist by PhD, but then again, back in the 18th century, everybody did everything. You weren't specialized as very, but no, Immanuel Kant never traveled more than 100 miles from his hometown. And we live in a world where, a week ago Sunday, we'd go Monday, actually, I got on the airplane. I was living in Brazil, and now I'm in like, where? And I don't know, the context that we have and the context that we remake are quite different from the context in which Kant and Descartes and even Whitehead, Nietzsche, Heidegger, in which they worked. Even just the last century, we have changed an awful lot. I also make the argument that in our basis, our emotional basis, we haven't changed that much, but the way the emotions play out in the context that we make in our different contexts are quite different from Kant. And I sometimes want to throw him out completely. He just really ticks me off because of some of the things he wrote about Africans that we sort of brush under the rug. And that's problematic for me. I think we need, again, to know the context, know the people whom we read, not just for their writings, because their writings all have a context. And that Kant and his critique of pure reason, his critique of pure emotion, and a couple other of his key writings are written from a very specific, localized context, highly speculative about other people's. So, I've got some of my tirade out of the way. So I mentioned the conference in 2001 in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Unfortunately, the book hasn't been published yet. Fortunately for me, Jonathan Hess, who was one of the presenters, has shared some of he's published his book based on, which works around the question of the Jews in Germany in the 18th century, and the writings of Johann David Michaelis. And it's quite, again, I mentioned on Monday that Michaelis was apt as a Christian theologian. This is an important part for me. As a Lutheran Christian theologian, was thoroughly convinced, or maybe he was, Reformed / Lutheran in that combination up in Göttingen. Göttingen was sort of an advanced outpost. I mentioned already. But let's just leave it with a Christian theologian. He was thoroughly convinced that the Jews were so degenerate, and that's a technical term, for that God created everybody. God created human beings. Sort of the model that was in vogue, and sort of a pyramid, and that the Caucasian males at the top of the pyramid with the Caucasian female slightly below, as the norm, and the female slightly below because she's not quite normal because she doesn't have a penis. I'm normal. Of course it works that way. And then Asians and others, finally at the bottom of the Africans, who are furthest from the standard, the imagined standard, were degenerating from that point of the pyramid. That was going on in the 18th century, but as the titles for today suggest, and finally we get there, they're not alone. And what I want to focus on mostly first is the Spanish, who were not passive viewers of this drama that was playing itself out in the new Atlantic world. And think about the paradigm shift that's going on. If I'm right about in what I said on Tuesday, what Brodal has it coming, going up through the 16th, 17th century, that we had thought about the world as the Mediterranean world. Europe and the Mediterranean, that's who we thought of ourselves. Now, in the early 16th century and moving out gradually through the 16th into the 17th century, we're working with an Atlantic world. We're going down
by the end of the 15th century, we're at the point of the Cape of Africa. We know about the Americas, both north and south, and we're expanding. We've met these new people, you know, these Africans. We've met Amerindians, indigenous people, who will later be classified in Blumenbach's schema as other races. But Martinez deals with, which was extremely helpful for me, almost a breakthrough when I found her article, and they were kind of sending one from the Harvard Symposium on the Atlantic world. Religion, purity, and race. You know, this is the difference. Blumenbach makes it an academic discipline, an academic scientific category. Micaela sort of pulls it back into the religious world, where it had been since the Spanish Inquisition. For those of you who are Monty Python fans, you know
about
No one escapes. Especially according to Martinez, or Nash / Martinez, especially if you have brown skin. She says that beginning in the 15th century, they had this problem, 1492, right? Columbus gets here, or somewhere around here. Right? He didn't know exactly where he was. He discovered he was lost in America. Michael Moore. It's also the date that we traditionally put on the expulsion of the last Muslims and Jews who had not yet converted from Spain and the Iberian Peninsula. So there have been a lot of people in the meantime. This is not like, you know, 1491, let's start this, you know, shock and awe and get rid of the Jews and the Muslims. It took centuries to get these people out. And one of the options that was offered is, you know, if you really don't want to move and you really don't want to die, you could become Catholic. You know? Christian. I'm just saying Catholic because we're Lutherans here. Most of us, many of us, we often identify ourselves by not being Catholic. That's our major identity point. So there were lots of people in Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, and in Europe who had chosen not to move, had chosen not to die, and became Christians. Well, that's fine, except, well, we don't really trust you. The idea of it's in your blood, which still hangs on in some bizarre ways today. It's changed a little bit, it's in his DNA or in her DNA. Some people are genetically predisposed to good or bad. Also had a role in understanding how people were genetically, by bloodlines, predisposed to be good or bad, predisposed to be Jewish or Muslim. And so we have to go through a process of cleaning the blood. And this is going to take, you know, the science and theology of the 16th century, 15th century, it's 15th and 16th century, so it's going to take three or four generations. So, I, being a good pious Jew, decided, well, it's better to be alive and be an ex-Jew Christian than to be a dead Jew. Fine, I get to live, you know. My son or my daughter, well, in this case, my son, might decide, well, I would really like, I am a Christian. I was baptized from birth, came out of the womb, went to the church, was baptized, the appropriate fellow with all my peers. Why can't I participate? Well, son, you got this Jewish blood, or this Muslim blood, Islamic blood, and it's going to be a while before that blood's cleaned out, and there's not a tendency to backslide, fall back into the old federal religion. Of course, they knew that there were lots of grim, that a lot of people converted and still maintained the cult of the other in home. And so let's make sure grandma's at least gone, because grandma's the least likely to have a similar. So three or four generations, in some cases,
let's make sure that there's no memory. So if you know your mom told you what her grandma told her about my granddad being a Jew or a Muslim, and so then you tell, well, yeah, my son's a third or fourth generation, so he's cool. He can now step into positions of authority as an old Christian who's no longer a new Christian after fourth generation. But if you remember and you say something, he's an old Christian. As long as somebody remembers, in some cases, that was as long as the spot is in the memory, these people were still new Christians and therefore under law. Now, this is clearly a religious problem, issue, racialization in a specific context. But, of course, it's also about power. Who's going to enter into the church council? who can own property? And how they can own property? Remember that Jews, for a long time, could not own property in most of Europe, and that's why you know when you read Shakespeare and when you read history, you see them in some peculiar professions because those were the only ones that were open to them. You know, that's why Jews pretty much run the diamond industry in Holland and Brussels, because they can hold property, that they can put in the lining of their coat, that they can take with them, but they couldn't own land, because that was for the real Dutch Christians, the real Belgian Christians, and, the real German, French, English Christians. So the Jews are themselves, as often in Shakespeare, as the moneylenders. Which was a despicable thing because usury is prohibited in the Bible. Maybe if only among Jews. Maybe you can lend money to Christians and non-religious people. So it's about maintaining power in Europe. And when the Europeans came to, in the case of Martinez's research, New Spain, Mexico. But notice the subtitle here. 17th century Mexico and the broader Atlantic world. Well, we're all the center of the universe with our research. We hope that, you know, we hope we're right about what we've researched. And then we hope further that it fits someplace else. And I don't know anybody that's done this in Brazil, done this research in Brazil, but it sounds, from what I've seen in Brazil, it sounds like it worked pretty well throughout the Iberian conquest of the New World.
Peter, just as a footnote, in Guatemala, the Creole community are consider themselves to be clean blood. They are the landowners, 15 families. They only today intermarry in that family or with select Europeans. Mm-hmm. And they maintain control of 90-some% of the land in Guatemala.
Now, Creole, is that well, we just talk about the sense of it, and you tell me if it means the same thing. Creole, which we often in the United States associate with New Orleans and some really fine cooking, in Spanish of the 16th century, 15th, 16th century, 17th century, meant children born to Spanish parents in the New World. Mm-hmm. Now this question of land and where one is born, like with blood and who your parents are, whether you have noble blood, which I didn't mention, was also a criteria. So Creole is not the mixture that we think of today in this text, but it is those who regard themselves as...
It's pure Spanish.
It's pure Spanish, but born in the New World.
And that's exactly how the term is used.
Exactly how the term is used.
And they even have private chapels. And the church still acquiesces to that. The Roman Catholic had private chapels for the families.
Mm-hmm. They did that in Spain, that's, to the wealthy families. I just went to Spain last fall, and the wealthy people owned their own chapels and funeral chapels, and only the family could go into the inner part, and then they would let other people come in, but they had to stay in the outer.
One element of this that became, I wouldn't say clear to me, but became possible for me to at least begin to see in Brazil, is that whereas we tend to think along racial lines in the United States, in old Europe, not Dave Don Rumfeld's old Europe, but in the Spanish, Iberian, Germanic, to some extent the Nordic Europe, noble blood is an important thing. Mm-hmm. And to mixing up this noble blood and sharing this noble blood was not at all a concept that they thought of. So it's a matter of keeping the bloodlines pure, maintaining, because that maintained that presumed a certain kind of moral, ethical code. You know, you see these stories about Zorro and so on, and the nobility believes themselves to be morally superior, morally and ethically superior to everyone else. It's a very common idea in the old world, which came over to the new world. We, in some ways, have gotten rid of it, unless, of course, you went to Harvard or Yale or Penn or you try to marry somebody from Harvard, Yale, Penn, Princeton, Ivy League schools. But we maintain it in some ways. And it's funny, this last election, I'm still kind of pissed off about it, as you may have noted from some of the things I've said. But even if Gore had won, you know, we had Tennessee, Massachusetts, Texas, Florida, nobility, political nobility, and the Bush family. Then we had a Tennessee nobility family and the Al Gore family. Al Gore's dad tried to be president so many times, and when he gave up, he pushed it onto his son, who then took over his political machine in the same way that Jeb and George Bush have taken over dad's political machine. So it's often the lesser of two evils in that regard, in terms of who gets to participate, really, in the formation of U.S. policy. And if you look at who George W. Bush, gosh, really spinning off here today, whom George W. Bush has appointed, it's really frightening. Anthony Scalia's son, Rehnquist's son, wives and brothers and cousins of his chief administrators are holding subsidiary posts throughout the Bush administration. So to the victors still go the spoils. But at least we make the judgment not on the basis of, not entirely, not explicitly on the basis of bloodlines. So, long parentheses closed again. When this came over to the New World, these categories had to be established to make sure that the Jews and the Muslims who came over with the real Spaniards, I mean, the old Christians, these new Christians, didn't step into positions of authority. So, first question that the Inquisition or La Suprema, the tribunal of the Inquisition, who then was charged with sort of Supreme Court kind of responsibility for interpreting how we're going to, determining how we're going to live out the new reconquest of the world under the Holy See, with the Spanish as sort of the primary force defending the Pope, the reformed, regained power over Europe, and then moving down the coast of Africa and moving into the Americas. Zorro is a good movie to go back, the new Zorro is a good movie to go back and remind ourselves just how Spanish the United States was. This year, what a good year, we're the bicentennial of the Louisiana Purchase. Reminder said we bought this from Napoleon, but remember Louisiana was named for the Spanish queen, not for the French. So this huge piece of territory in the middle, and this piece coming up through Mexico and up the California coast, which we eventually went to war to get in the 1840s, that Spain had an incredible influence and still has an incredible influence in North America, as well as Central America and South America. Then we had this problem that
unlike North American, unlike English, primarily English and some Germanic colonial endeavors in North America, the Spanish and the Portuguese didn't go there for the most part to live. They wanted to go and pull out things, make their name. Often it was a second child who wasn't going to inherit so much at home, but had a piece of land given to him, second son given to him, and the New World he'd go and hope to, you know, with his little mini army, conquer some things, send some presents back to the queen and the king, and get a new title, then to move, go back to Spain, go back to Portugal. And the people that came with them, I mean, maybe the nobles were a little more careful, but the people who came with them were not quite so careful, and they basically lay down with whomever they could. And so suddenly we have a generation of mestizos, of mixed blood mestizos mulattos, people who are part Spanish, but maybe, but not necessarily, and not in all cases, nobility, noble blood, mixed with, you know, these indigenous people and these African slaves who have been baptized, by the way. It's part of the thing that you had to do if you wanted to be a slave. You had to be baptized first. No, because the Pope was going to get his part of the payment. And it's an all very complex sort of thing, but the tax, church tax, part of it went back to the Pope. It didn't just go back to the Pope. It went back to the Queen of England, the King of England, went back to Germany. Everybody was mixed up in this. It wasn't just the Spanish, it wasn't just the Germans. We all, this, as they say, there's guilt enough to go, there's blame enough to go around in this fiasco. So then these laws that were applied to Creoles, were then readjusted to talk about the new converts, you know, indigenous, first the mestizos, and then just the people who were still, the indigenous folk who were living as some sort of servants or subservient people to the new Spanish culture, and the slaves who were supporting this. Now, this is the twist and turns that this takes become interesting, because it was a religious distinction initially. Right? It becomes now a socio-religious, geographical distinction. And now we've got these new Christians who are not pagans. That is, they didn't have bad religion before. They had, according to the Pope, they had no religion. Mm-hmm. You know? African religion, we don't understand it, so it's not a religion. It's heathenism. Indigenous religion, we don't understand it, so it's not a religion. It's not a system. It's heathenism. So, in spite of the fact that La Suprema said initially these rules don't apply to them because their conversions are conversions from heathenism, and they're in no danger of returning to their previous faith or the faith of their forebears, these rules for new Christians in three or four generations didn't apply. Welcome. Of course, you know, they were brown-skinned. They were childlike. Mm-hmm. And so they, you know, as a culture, and so it was going to take generations anyway for them to move into positions of authority, if ever. And I think Robert and Linda will share with me, confirm for me that they're still children in the minds of the patrones and patrones. That's what you saw in Guatemala. So, at first, come on in, but it's going to take you a while for other reasons, for simply cultural reasons now. But as things moved along and more mulattos, more mestizos came along, and more the noble blood was more diffuse. There was basically less control, and because there were more people involved, there was an interesting split that occurred. The indigenous folk who converted more or less voluntarily,
those who were wise enough to see that it was better to be alive than a live dog than a dead lion, as the proverb is telling us, were considered to have converted voluntarily. But since the Africans were forced, I mean, they were literally sprinkled by the bishop as they went onto the boat, and they got baptized and they got branded. Isn't that cool? They realized later, well, you know, these African descendant folk, they didn't really convert. You know, they didn't make a voluntary conversion, so they have to reconvert. They have to do it once again, and then they'll be like the new Christians, which is this category that we have in our legal text, which applies only to Jews, which we've already decided applies only to Jews and Muslims. But we'll apply it to them because we basically need something to keep them down for another couple of centuries. Well, maybe I'm a little cynical about that. But the La Suprema had already said these rules cannot be applied to Africans, but then they came back and said they're not voluntary conversions, and so they have to convert again. And you can, in Brazil, you can go to some of the old monasteries in their graveyards and see the dozens and dozens of brothers and cousins of Afro-descendants because of the names. Names like Da Silva from the forest, from the wilderness. Dos Santos from the saints. These are names that are traditionally names given by the priests to black Brazilians when they converted of their own free will. And there is some confusion of this in Brazil because Brazil, by accident, had a fairly large Muslim population from the slaves that they brought over. Currently, they kind of the big slave traders with the big guns sort of turned on their slave trading partners, who many of whom were Muslim, and couldn't tell one black from the other, and put them all on the boat, and they ended up here. And so until 1848, there was a large importation of Islamic peoples as slaves, but they could talk to each other. They couldn't separate them because they all spoke Arabic. Mm-hmm. And so in 1848, there was the third large slave rebellion in Bahia, which is the first capital of Brazil. And then from that point on, they didn't import any more Muslim slaves into Brazil. Just a side note, how dangerous religion can be when you're trying to dominate people. So that's a little background. Yeah, one more place with it. The Germans are not alone. The Spanish had a lot of help, gave a lot of help in this. And as I said, you know, we all know that the British were involved. The British backed out. British was the first major power to decry slavery and call for the abolition of slavery, and we kind of think of them as good guys for that. And of course, there were some religious motivation for that, but the biggest motivation politically was the fact that slavery in the United States meant that the Americans, the people who would become the North American, the U.S. citizens, could produce cotton for the textile mills at a price that undercut the British textile industry. So it wasn't all Quakerdom and purity that led the English to be the first superpower to call for the end of slavery. Just a little bit about Catherine Tanner here. Her stuff is really worth reading. It's kind of dense, but in the first chapter of her book, she talks about how culture means a lot of different things to a lot of people. We have to acknowledge that up front. And where she talks about it most is back in the 16th, 17th, 18th century in Europe, principally. She divides the Germanic idea, the French idea, and the English ideas of culture as separate lines, even though the Germans said Kultur, and I don't know how the French said it, and the English said culture. They were talking about three different things. France was basically manners. England was custom.
and Germany, if I hope I've divided correctly, in Germany it was being well-educated, well-informed. This is a period when the poets were so important to the Germans, the romantic poets. I mentioned this before, the ability to express oneself clearly and passionately. This was culture for German, and in culture, Kultur in German still has more of a sense of artistic and refinement that the French and the English doesn't quite carry. So how theology interacts with culture is what she's dealing with, and she tries to move us to a place where we can think a little more clearly and with a little more self-critical reflection about how our cultures and our ideas about culture affect our theological positions, our theological ideas. So just a couple of words about it. What time is it?
It's 25 till.
So not too much already. Right. Any questions or clarifications, observations?
Does she talk at all about what culture is to America then at all? Or?
I honestly don't remember what she says, so I'm going to make something up.
I think that's a really fascinating hearing for us right now.
That's definitely where she wants to get us to. Mm-hmm. Because she starts where she does and when where she's going, I vaguely remember that we are a combination of these things and that we need to sort this out in the States as to what we think culture is.
Yeah.
And remember, she's right. She's someone who grew up in the culture wars. I mean, academically grew up during the culture wars,
okay,
where we don't quite know what we're fighting over. What cultures have legitimacy and what cultures don't, who gets to decide and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
During the time that England was backing away from slavery, wasn't she still colonizing and enslaving people that she, India, Rhodesia, these different things. So the kind of slavery changed, but the actions were still the same.
Yeah. I do think that this is one of my pet projects, is to try to get African Americans to think differently about Africa. I think that at least an interesting journey to go back and talk about my roots is to go to Latin America as it is to go to Africa. I've been lucky enough to do both, more time in Latin America. But that's a more similar process. Colonization and enslavement, in my mind, are different things. In enslavement, you pull somebody out of his or her environment and take them someplace else, and they have to reinvent everything. In the colonization situation, you invade somebody else's spot. You set up your provisional governments and then your permanent governments, and then you teach them to be just like you in a different sort of process. In 1994, there was a conference in Brazil. It was the year before I got there, but the book came out just after I got to Brazil, called Afro-American Theology. And they invited some Africans, a couple of North Americans. And this was the chief difference that they cited. And I think others have done that before, that the process of decolonizing oneself, in this case in Africa, is different from the process of liberating an enslaved mind and culture, and the enslaved minds and cultures in the Americas. There's a lot of stuff in common, and because we were messed with by the same people in many cases. But for example, South Africa was just an absurd situation of about 10% of the population running the whole show. Well, in the United States, we're only 10-12% of the population.
Yeah.
So it's even in the political system, it becomes a very different question of how one manifests one's voice. One person, one vote has a different sound to an African American from what it has to a South African.
Mm.
Bernal, what the thing that sort of set me off here is Martin Bernal. Set me off in this, set me off in this direction is Martin Bernal. And some other stuff that's been published in the last 20 years. Bernal, with the title already, ticks some people off. Black Athena. There are, all of you, or most of you are aware of the Afrocentrist controversies in the United States and in France. It's not just here. France is not so controversial. It's very controversial in the United States.
Say that again.
The Afrocentrist controversies. There are some people who believe fervently, have their evidence lined up, that everything great that ever happened because some African somewhere or some Afro-descendant acted and made things possible. And to some extent, and some Afrocentrists simply want to move Europe out of the center. They're on the extreme side. On one extreme side, there are those who want to put Africa at the center of everything. They see Africa as the center of everything. There are others who call themselves Afrocentrists who simply want to take Europe out of the center of Western history and establish that a lot of interesting things happened in Africa that made possible the ascent of Western civilization. Bernal, who is an English Jew academic, sort of stumbled into this argument of this part of the culture wars. Oh, let me just go back a second and say that we're celebrating Lewis and Clark this year, we're celebrating the Louisiana Purchase this year, and to show just what kind of an Afrocentrist I am, it would have never happened if it hadn't been for a black man. If, I've forgotten his real name now, but it's Toussaint Louverture, had not led a successful rebellion in Haiti, that eliminated the possibility of Napoleon coming through the Caribbean and encircling encircling from the Canadian side and from the Caribbean side the British colonies. If that war with the Haitians hadn't gone on so long, Napoleon would have never sold the Louisiana territories to Thomas Jefferson. So anybody who lives, in the old Louisiana Purchase territory owns that in part to a Haitian black general who had been a slave and saw his way free and became the general and leader of the Haitian resistance back in the 1790s. He died, by the way, in a French prison. But that's true. Right? That's documented. You can even read that in the New York Times. So we know it's true. Things like that, Bernal wants to recapture. He raises the question. Remember, he is a Chinese specialist who has moved over for about 10 years now, by the time he writes Black Athena, publishes Black Athena, into the bridge between the ancient Semitic world and the classical world, which do share a lot of things in common. And he highlights two parts. He highlights the contribution on the seas of the Phoenicians. And most of us know that the alphabet is, in fact, a Semitic contribution to Western civilization. Aleph, Alpha, Beta means literally ox, which the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet was supposed to represent in when its pictographic form. Beit, Bayit, house. Yeah? The Greeks took over the alphabet from the movement to the Phoenicians. The Greeks took it over and changed it to Alpha, Beta, Gamma, and so on. Gamma was Gimel, camel. And when you see the letter, it looks like sort of like a camel. It's one of the few letters that still looks like it. And then they added the vowels, and they changed the direction of the writing to better suit them. But that's one of the things that every linguist knows, that they should know if they graduated. That the Greek alphabet, which led to the Roman alphabet, which we use, came from the Phoenician alphabet, which is the Hebrew Aramaic alphabet. Comes from the Proto-Sinaitic pictographic alphabet. So stuff like that kind of turns Bernal on. He wants to know, why is it that the Phoenician influence on the seas, the Phoenicians were the seafarers before the Greeks. He wants to know why the Egyptian influence on mathematics and literature and art. There are Greek myths, Greek stories, you know, it depends on whether you like them or not, whether they're myths, stories, or history. That Athens was actually an Egyptian colony. You know? During the Roman period, the adorations of Isis, an Egyptian goddess, was still so powerful that it had to be outlawed at one point because it challenged authority of the Roman emperor. So there's a ton of Egyptian influence that prevailed in Europe even up until the 18th century. Look at our dollar bill on the back. You mm-hmm. see that pyramid and that all-seeing eye. Mm-hmm. You know, so the Freemasons, which were really big in Europe, especially England, in this period, they went back to Africa, back to Egypt, because the pyramids were the most fantastic engineering architectural feat ever in their minds. And so they, you know, all of our founding fathers, most of our founding fathers were in some way tied up in the Masonic mess. Excuse me if you're a Mason, I don't know anything about them except for that. You know, when I read the Sherlock Holmes mysteries. So Bernal, went back, and if he redid classical history, he said, he suggested that it was the anti-Semitism, the Phoenicians are Semitic people, and the anti-Africanism of the late Enlightenment that coincided with the formation of the great German university that rethought, reconstructed classical civilization. During the Renaissance, into the Enlightenment, Egypt had been everything. And during this period, Egypt was pushed down, he suggests, because it was an African country. The Phoenicians were pushed out of the picture, he suggests, because of the rabid anti-Semitism that was going on in Germany. And the construction of the university then elevated classical civilization to a point that to a glory that it had not previously enjoyed. And, late 17th and early 18th centuries. Now, why did I get involved in this? I thought, you know, this guy writes, you know, some of it's crazy, you know, some of it's wrong, and he's admitted to that. Not that it's crazy, but that it's wrong. Some of it's right. And what struck me is that this was 1987 when the first volume came out, 1992 when the second volume came out, and I have never, unless I was given the lecture, I have never heard an Old Testament or New Testament professor in a Christian seminary talk about this book. I mean, someone has managed to challenge in such a form that the classical scholars went bananas, went absolutely bananas, wrote at least three large books and hundreds of articles disputing what he had to say, supporting in some cases, correcting in other cases what he had to say. And the church, which claims to base its trajectory on classical text, or the Greco-Roman, if the Greco-Roman world was different from what we were taught over in the classics department, well, why aren't we redoing it in the New Testament department? If Afro-Asiatic civilization had an influence on classical civilization in a different form from what we've been teaching, and Bernal has got the Egyptologist in a row as well. It's not just the classicists, but also some of the Egyptologists. Why is it that those of us who claim to study Northwest Semitic languages, which was my discipline, those of us who study ancient Near Eastern history, which is a cognate discipline for our Old Testament study, why aren't we writing and talking about this? Why isn't this something that we're involved in? And so that got me kind of headed down this road. Any questions about that, or comments, observations? How much time do I have left?
10 till.
I'm over time. Okay, the dead white guy. Ivan Hannaford, taught classics, and he decided to do a, he was sort of perplexed, he's an Englishman, perplexed as to why, how race got played out in the West. And in like three or four sentences I'll say this. He went back and read through the history of, he developed the history of race as an intellectual idea in the West. And he said it comes back to the same period, 17th century, 17th, 18th century, and the desire to create, to model ourselves being the modern West, on classical civilization and misreading, especially, he says, the Timaeus. Now, that's a big, thick book, oversized, so I'm really summarizing too much here. The Timaeus and the Republic. And so the idea of citizenship in the West, based on one's contribution, one's ability to give and contribute to the society, was somehow twisted so that race, color, nation replaced contribution to the polis, to the civitas. And that was able then to spin out into flat out race and racism in the modern West. So, the books are available. I recommend, and not because I have anything against them, I use them when they're cheapest and quickest. Powells.com, Daedalus.com. They sell cheap and the remainder books, and you can get a copy of any one of these. Well, the first is only a paper. You can write to Harvard and look on the Harvard website for the Atlantic History Symposium, and they'll send you a copy of that paper if you're real nice to me.
I think this is a really hopeful message for the church in America right now. I think, you know, because we're so primed to look to Greek and Roman classical history, whether that priming was proper or not, we're so primed to think of that as sort of the golden age, and to sort of demonstrate to our young people that, you know, those were very metropolitan communities, and they had lots of languages going on and lots of cultural influences going on, and I think it would be kind of a word to say, you know, yeah, this mixing bowl that we say is America, that was there then too, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you kind of glory in that.
I think we can, but we've got to rewrite history. For example, Eratosthenes, yeah, which is not a very common name, but he's always listed in the encyclopedias as sort of a second level philosopher, but a pretty good mathematician. Eratosthenes is the guy who gave us the sieve through which the method for determining what's a prime number, right? Eratosthenes of Cyrene. Where have we heard of Cyrene before?
Simon
of Cyrene, one of the few people that we quickly acknowledge as an African in the New Testament. But when you read about him, well, go home and do a Google search on Eratosthenes or prime numbers, and he should come up there. And you'll read, he was a Greek. He was a Greek philosopher from Cyrene, where they already had a Greek school of philosophy, second generation out from Plato. Really funny, the Cyrenians, I think they're called, they're a really funny kind of philosophical school. He spent 5 years in Athens, and they call him a Greek philosopher. Mm-hmm. And he's from North Africa.
Yeah.
Now, explain that to me. If I spent 8 years in Brazil, I am not Brazilian. So it is hopeful if we can get people to read behind what is always put out there in front. Mm-hmm. Another thing, when you live way out there and have the internet, which we don't have here at Holden, you become dependent on the internet in a very scary sort of way. I was trying to run some of this stuff down, and there are already novels and movies written about how the hate groups are using the internet. What you and I would regard as hopeful, there's a whole page, whole website, about how the decline of the Roman Empire was because they were no longer Romans. And they were able to be defeated by the Teutons, you know, because they had become so miscegenated. Now, what this poor sap doesn't realize is that those Germanic peoples who came in were actually Asiatics. And he didn't quite get that detail in his website. But that was the point, the main point of the site, as I was trying to run some of this stuff down, was that the problem with the Roman Empire at the end was that they had too many black people. So. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you.